In The Great Technology, published in 1933, Harold Rugg elucidated the grand vision, quote, "A new public mind is to be created. How? Only by creating tens of millions of individual minds and welding them into a new social mind. Old stereotypes must be broken up and new climates of opinion formed in the neighborhoods of America. Through the schools of the world, we shall disseminate a new conception of government, one that will embrace all the activities of men, one that will postulate the need of scientific control in the interest of all people," close quote. In similar fashion, the work of the Social Science Research Council culminated in a statement of conclusions and recommendations on its Carnegie Foundation-funded operations, which had enormous and lasting impact upon education in the United States. Conclusions, published in 1934, heralded the decline of the old order, stating aggressively that, quote, "a new age of collectivism is emerging," close quote, which will involve the supplanting of private property by public property and will require experimentation and almost certainly a large measure of compulsory cooperation of citizens, a corresponding enlargement of the functions of government, and increasing state intervention. Rights will be altered and abridged, close quote. Conclusions was a call to the teachers' colleges to instruct their students to condition children into an acceptance of the new order in progress. Reading, writing, and arithmetic were to be marginalized as irrelevant, even counterproductive. Quote, "As often repeated, the first step is to consolidate leadership around the philosophy and purpose of education herein expounded," close quote. The difficulties in trying to understand what such an odd locution as compulsory cooperation might really mean, or even trying to determine what historic definition of education would fit such a usage, were ignored. To those who wrote this report, and some of those who read it, were the only ones who held the Rosetta Stone to decipher it. In an article in Progressive Education magazine, Professor Norman Wolfel produced one of the many children and grandchildren of the conclusions report when he wrote in 1946, quote, "It might be necessary for us to control our press as the Russian press is controlled and as the Nazi press is controlled," close quote. A startling conclusion he improved upon in his book Molders of the American Mind, published in 1933, with this dark beauty, quote, "In the minds of men who think experimentally, America is conceived as having a destiny which bursts the all-too-obvious limitations of Christian religious sanctions," close quote. The Rockefeller-endowed Lincoln Experimental School at Columbia Teachers College was a testing ground for Harold Rugg's series of textbooks, which moved 5 million copies by 1940, and millions more after that. In these books, Rugg advanced his theory, quote, "Education must be used to condition the people to accept social change. The chief function of schools is to plan the future of society," close quote. Like many of his activities over three vital decades on the school front, the notions Rugg put forth in The Great Technology, published in 1933, were eventually translated into practice in urban centers. Rugg advocated the major task of schools be seen as indoctrinating youth, using social science as the, quote, "core of the school curriculum to bring about the desired climate of public opinion." Some attitudes Rugg advocated teaching were reconstruction of the national economic system to provide for central controls and an implantation of the attitude that educators as a group were a, quote, "vastly superior priesthood." "Our task is to create swiftly a compact body of minority opinion for the scientific reconstruction of our social order." Money for Rugg's six textbooks came from Rockefeller Foundation grants to the Lincoln School. He was paid two salaries by the foundation, one as an educational psychologist for Lincoln, the other as professor of education at Teachers College, in addition to salaries for secretarial and research services. The General Education Board provided funds equivalent to $500,000 in year 2000 purchasing power to produce three books, which were then distributed by the National Education Association. In 1954, a second congressional investigation of foundation tampering with schools and American social life was attempted, headed by Carol Reese of Tennessee. The Reese Commission quickly ran into a buzzsaw of opposition from influential centers of American corporate life. Major national newspapers hurled scathing criticisms, which, together with pressure from other potent political adversaries, forced the committee to disband prematurely, but not before there were some tentative findings. Quote, "The power of the individual large foundations is enormous. Its various forms of patronage carry with them elements of thought control. It exerts immense influence on educational processes and educational institutions. It is capable of invisible coercion. It can materially predetermine the development of social and political concepts, academic opinion, thought leadership, public opinion. The power to influence national policy is amplified tremendously when foundations act in concert. There is such a concentration of foundation power in the United States, operating in education and the social sciences, with a gigantic aggregate of capital and income. This interlock has some of the characteristics of an intellectual cartel. It operates in part through certain intermediary organizations supported by the foundations. It has ramifications in almost every phase of education. It has come to exercise very extensive practical control over social science and education. A system has arisen which gives enormous power to a relatively small group of individuals, having at their virtual command huge sums in public trust funds. The power of the large foundations and the interlock has so influenced press, radio, television, and even government that it has become extremely difficult for objective criticism of anything the interlock approves to get into news channels without having first been ridiculed, slanted, and discredited. Research in the social sciences plays a key part in the evolution of our society. Such research is now almost wholly in the control of professional employees of the large foundations. Even the great sums allotted by federal government to social science research have come into the virtual control of this professional group. Foundations have promoted a great excess of empirical research as contrasted with theoretical research, promoting an irresponsible fact-finding mania, leading all too frequently to scientism or fake science. Associated with the excessive support of empirical method, the concentration of foundation power has tended to promote moral relativity to the detriment of our basic moral, religious, and governmental principles. It has tended to promote the concept of social engineering, that foundation-approved social scientists alone are capable of guiding us into better ways of living, substituting synthetic principles for fundamental principles of action. These foundations and their intermediaries engage extensively in political activity, not in the form of direct support of candidates or parties, but in the conscious promotion of carefully calculated political concepts. The impact of foundation money upon education has been very heavy, tending to promote uniformity in approach and method, tending to induce the educator to become an agent for social change and a propagandist for the development of our society in the direction of some form of collectivism. In the international field, foundations and the interlock, together with intermediary organizations, have exercised a strong effect upon foreign policy and upon public education in things international. This has been accomplished by vast propaganda, by supplying executives and advisors to government, and by controlling research through the power of the purse. The net result has been to promote, quote, internationalism in a particular sense, a form directed toward world government and a derogation of American nationalism, close quote. Hence, we find ourselves confronted with the puzzling duty of interpreting why two separate congressional committees convened 50 years apart to study the working of the new foundation institutions, one under a Democratic Congress, one under a Republican Congress, both reached essentially the same conclusions. Both adjudged foundations a clear and present danger to the traditional liberties of American national life. Both pointed to the use of foundation influence to create the blueprint of American school life. Both saw that a class system in America had emerged and was being supported by the class system in schooling. Both called for drastic action, and both were totally ignored. Actually, the word ignored doesn't begin to do justice to what really occurred. These congressional investigations, like Sir Walter Scott's difficult-to-obtain Life of Napoleon Bonaparte, have not only vanished from public imagination, they aren't even alluded to in press discussions of schooling, exactly as if they had never happened. This would be more understandable if their specific philanthropies were dull, pedestrian giveaways designed to distribute largesse and build up good feeling toward the benevolence of colossal wealth and power. But the reality is strikingly different. A corporate wealth through the foundations has advanced, importantly, the dumbing down of America's schools, the creation of a scientific class system, and important attacks on family integrity, national identification, religious rights, and national sovereignty. School is the cheapest police, Horace Mann said. Sears, Pierce, Harris, Stowe, Lancaster, and the rest, prominently involved in creating universal school systems for coal powers. One only has to browse Merle Curti's The Social Ideas of American Educators to discover that the greatest social idea educators had to sell the rich, and which they lost no opportunity to sell, was the police function of schooling. Although a pedagogical turn in the Quaker imagination is the reason schools came to look like penitentiaries, Quakers are not the principal reason they came to function like maximum security institutions. The reason they came to exist at all was to stabilize the social order and train the ranks. In a scientific, industrialized, corporate age, stability was much more exquisitely defined than ordinary people could imagine. To realize the new stability, the best breeding stock had to be drawn up into reservations. Likewise, the ordinary. The Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede is only a small piece of the puzzle. Many more efficient and subtler quarantines were essayed. I'll just interject here that the Daughters of the Barons of Runnymede, which is actually the title of this chapter, refers to one of the hereditary societies of Anglo-Saxon blood that was established during the time period in question as part of the bringing of caste to American society, says Gatto. And I will continue. Perhaps subtlest of all was the welfare state, a welfare program for everybody, including the lowest, in which the political state bestowed alms the way the corporate church used to do. Although the most visible beneficiaries of this gigantic project were those groups increasingly referred to as masses, the poor were actually people most poorly served by this latter-day Hindu creation of Fabian socialism and the corporate brain trust. Subsidizing the excluded of the new society and economy was, it was believed, a humanitarian way to calm these troubled waters until the Darwinian storm had run its inevitable course into a new genetically arranged utopia. A report issued in 1982 and widely publicized in important journals, the connection between corporate capitalism and the welfare state becomes manifest in a public document bearing the name Alan Pfeiffer, then president of the Carnegie Corporation. Apparently fearing that the Reagan administration would alter the design of the Fabian Project beyond its ability to survive, Pfeiffer warned of, quote, a mounting possibility of severe social unrest and the consequent development among the upper classes and the business community of sufficient fear for the survival of our capitalist economic system to bring about an abrupt change of course. Just as we built the general welfare state and expanded it in the 1960s as a safety valve for the easing of social tension, so we will do it again in the 1980s. Any other path is too risky, close quote. In the report quoted from, new conceptions of pedagogy were introduced, which we now see struggling to be born. National certification for school teachers, bypassing the last vestige of local control in states, cities, and villages. A hierarchy of teachers' positions. A project to bring an end to the hierarchy of school administrators, now adjudged largely an expenditure counterproductive to good social order, a failed experiment. In the new form, lead teachers manage schools after the British fashion and hire business administrators. The first expressions of this new initiative included the mini-school movement, now evolved into the charter school movement. Without denying these ideas a measure of merit, if you understand that their source is the same institutional consciousness which once sent river ironclads full of armed detectives to break the steel union at Homestead, machine gun strikers at River Rouge, and burned to death over a dozen women and children in Ludlow, those memories should inspire emotions more pensive than starry-eyed enthusiasm.
Of course, I think Gatto's point that the capitalist system rests upon the forced schooling system, that only dumbed-down people could be tricked into supporting a system which is in so many ways in opposition to their interests, to the interests of pretty much any life form we care to mention, actually, but that the two go hand in hand. Now, this is an interesting thought when we reflect on the huge rise in homeschooling or unschooling, that actually the truth of what school mission is becoming clear to so many people that they no longer wish to support it. Now, who knows how long it will take for a critical mass of unschooled, free-thinking people to become adults and join the body politic, but this is a more pleasant dynamic to reflect on than the sheer horror of the environmental damage which is being conducted still at an ever-increasing rate, and which is also awakening adults to the destructiveness of the system which, through ignorance or inaction, they are supporting. Now we're going to hear from Charlotte Isabate, her experiences as senior policy advisor in the US Department of Education in the Reagan era, suggesting that whilst the public awareness of the nefarious purposes of schooling may have declined, little else has actually changed on its effectiveness at undermining free thinking, creativity, imagination, alternative ways of living, and supporting people in their submission to hierarchy. This interview is the audio track of a video of unknown provenance which I found on YouTube, but which is probably a few years old.
My name is Charlotte Thompson Isabate, and I served as senior policy advisor in the United States Department of Education under the Reagan administration, during which I had access to all of the most important documents for the restructuring of not only American education, but global education. And I'm also the author of The Deliberate Dumbing Down of America, which gets into all of this, gives the background of what I saw not only in the Department of Education, but as a local school board member. I was trained to identify the resistors. The resistors to the sex ed, drug ed, alcohol ed, suicide ed, death ed, those good, smart Americans who realize that anything that has education hanging off the end of it is probably not what they're looking for. I was trained to identify those good people and to go up against them and actually to go and try to get them to join us through the group process system, make them feel important, get them on a committee. And when that just blew my mind. I have to say, people often ask me, what is it that got you involved in education? Well, finding out what I saw at the local level certainly upset me. When I went and I saw that Americans were being trained to identify resistors, then I got pretty upset. And luckily, there was a big book that came with the in-service training called Innovations in Education, A Change Agent's Guide. And I was able to take that back home with me. Unbelievable examples of how to con the Christians and different people who are upset with what you're trying to do, how to bring them over to your side, case studies, true case studies of educators who had put programs in that normally, you know, in a normal American town, nobody would want them. How did they manage to get them in? How did they con the people? And the other thing was, not only was I trained to identify the resistors, I was trained to go to the important people, high-profile, highly thought-of people in the community, with the Rotary, and Chamber of Commerce, Garden Club, you name it, the different groups in our towns. Go to them and convince them of the importance of these new programs like sex ed, drug ed, I just mentioned all of them, and get them on your side, because when you can get the leadership in a community to go along with it, then the newspaper comes in and says, you know, a committee's been set up with the head of the Rotary and this and that, and they're all getting behind this task force to discuss whether we're going to have a new sex education program. And then when Mary Jones, you know, who ordinarily would think, why would we want to have a sex education program when we don't have any problems with kids having sex or anything? So she might be concerned. She might be one of the resistors. She reads that her best friend, who's the head of the Garden Club, is on this committee, and she thinks, oh, well, hey, Mary Appleton is on that committee. She's heading it up. It must be okay. So I was taught really how to con the community. They always call everybody by the first name. You have to get very, you know, affectionate with people and say, William, you know, I'm so glad you've come to this meeting, and I understand your concerns about this program, because I've had other people, usually it's the really bright people in the community who have these concerns, and would you like to join our group? The original program was funded by what would subsequently become my office. It was funded by the Office of Research in the U.S. Office of Education, because it was funded early on, about the late 60s, still funded, by the way. And the money went to the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor to a professor by the name of Ronald Havelock. And he was the one that put together the whole training, the whole seminar, the book. And in the back of the book you had, they admitted it, right in the back of the book, they had about 100 major change agents listed from all over the country. Some of them I recognize, some I still don't, but some I do. And so this was a very important project. And it was being, you know, it was being carried out in I'm sure, all over the country, not just where I was. This was in Searsport, Maine, this lovely little town on the coast of Maine, in the school there where the guy came in, the facilitator, not Professor Havelock, but a facilitator, to train us. And these were good people that were there. You know, they were some of the teachers from my school, where I was on the local school board, principals, etc. Normal-looking Americans. You know, you really ask yourself, they must themselves have reacted very much the way I did. That's why I've always had a lot of understanding for teachers that have to go through this stuff. I didn't have to continue going through it. They've had to, through the years, constant training, retraining, sensitivity training, break their values. Right, no wrong. You've got to have all religions represented, so, you know, tolerant of everything, and because that's the New World Order. Disorder, excuse me. Professor Benjamin Bloom is probably the most important behavioral psychologist ever to live. I mean, maybe not quite as much as Pavlov and Skinner, but he really implemented the system in education in the United States. And he was author of the taxonomy of educational objectives. And I know that doesn't mean much to us. It means a lot to teachers. They know. All teachers have to go through that. Bloom's taxonomy. And just to give you an idea of how blatant they are, Benjamin Bloom said the purpose of education, and I often say this to parents, really, listen to this. You think the purpose of education is reading, writing, and arithmetic? The purpose of education is to change the thoughts, actions, and feelings of students. And then he goes on and he says, he defines good teaching, and this is even worse from the parental standpoint, as challenging the students' fixed beliefs. And then in some of his works that I have, that are in my book, a lot of this stuff is in
When he says challenge, does he mean challenge or does he mean change? Change their fixed
beliefs? Yeah, through challenging. It's through challenging. You go up against them, and you change them. And you asked a good question, because then he goes on in one part of the taxonomy that is in my book. He says that he can take a student from here to there, from a belief in God or his country or whatever, to being an atheist and not believing in his country in 1 hour.
Did he do that?
Oh, yeah, he does it. And I've seen it with students. I've seen it with young people. And they don't even know. And teachers don't even know. That's why if you talk to teachers about it often, they'll really have an awfully hard time dealing with it. And if you go up to a superintendent, an educational administrator, superintendent or whatever, and you ask him or her, have you ever been through sensitivity training? They'll usually crack up because they went through it.
We're now going to conclude the show with the first half of a set of three programs. This is one of the first interviews that I ever heard with John Taylor Gatto from December 2004 by Radio Free School.
Hi, I'm John Taylor Gatto. I spent most of my life as John Gatto, but one day a principal named John Gatto called me from Long Island and said that his life was being destroyed, and could I find some way, please, he begged me, to discriminate this John Gatto from that John Gatto, or otherwise he said his goose was cooked. So I became John Gatto, John Taylor Gatto at that moment. I was a New York City public school teacher of junior high school kids for 30 years on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, which includes Harlem and Spanish Harlem. And I taught in both the white aristocratic ghetto of the Upper West Side of Manhattan and the Spanish ghetto of Manhattan and the black ghetto of Manhattan for 30 years. And during that time, I began to draw some conclusions about the institution of schooling, about the nature of kids and their learning. And when I left teaching in 1991 on an editorial on the op-ed page of the Wall Street Journal called I Quit, I Think, I was going to become a garlic farmer in upstate New York, and I do indeed own a farm there near Ithaca, New York. But I got a phone call from the Librarians Association in Colorado, of all places, and then I got another call a few days later, all based on the Wall Street Journal editorial from the Engineers Colloquium at NASA Goddard Space Center, and then I got a call from the vice president. And with those three appearances, I was off and running, although I never advertised. As the calls came in, I responded. And when I go to Australia next week or week after next to do the keynote for the Australia Education Convention, it will mark the 2 millionth mile I've traveled in the last 12 years. I had a tremendous anger, and the anger fueled me in trying to disseminate a message that schooling itself is a highly questionable practice, and that includes the good schools as well as the bad schools. It's possible to derive some value from it, but the danger and the damage is always, I think, much greater than the value that's possible. And in many, many instances, there's no value offered. It's simply a confinement exercise. When I started out, I probably, if I were to be classified, would have fit the definition of a school reformer. But the longer I researched, traveled, spoke, and reevaluated my 30 classroom years, which were, by the school's lights, quite successful. I was the New York State Teacher of the Year, and I was the New York City Teacher of the Year 3 consecutive years. So by the system's evaluation, I was doing great. But as I look back over my encounters with kids and parents and administrators and with myself, you know, I came to see a set of much darker themes than were evident to me in action. So I began to write books, and I've written four to this moment, and I'm working on a fifth, which I pray will be the last book. I never want to hear the word school for the rest of my life or see a school building. But I have taken a much darker tack, or it imposed itself on me. The more I understood the historical currents that were at work in creating this institution, the more I saw that it doesn't lead to the kind of world that I personally want to live in, that it definitely has a distinct purpose, and that purpose has been successfully achieved. And because of our schooling and the schooling in Britain and in Germany, our form of schooling has spread worldwide. So we now have a well-schooled planet. As I gaze out after 70 years of life, I'm not at all pleased with the planet, let alone with schooling.
What is the purpose of public education?
I would say that throughout Western history, and I won't pretend to know anything significant about Eastern history, but throughout Western history, schools existed. They were very short-term, and they were never considered very important. They would occupy 6 weeks or 2 months out of a year, and their stated purpose was to discover the will of God so that good lives could be led by harmonizing oneself with that will. So call that the first purpose of schooling. Call it the religious purpose. It is the ancient and common purpose. Somewhere around the time of the French Revolution, a second purpose emerged, not to say that it didn't always exist, but it emerged as dominant, and that was to make good citizens. A citizen is not somebody who follows orders. It's somebody who takes an active part in the public marketplace of ideas and deals himself or herself a seat at the policy table, whether the policy table wants him or not. So in order to have an opportunity to try to be a good citizen, you require a package of skills, two of which are quite possible to transmit through formal schooling. Those are to write well and convincingly in an organized fashion, and to speak well and convincingly in an organized fashion. Almost immediately from the inception of forced schooling, schools abandoned those purposes entirely. Some with no explanation, most with the explanation that there wasn't time to teach what used to be known as the active literacies. The reason writing and speaking are so drastically important to a citizen is that if you can read well and think well, you're still locked up in the prison of your own mind. You have to have rhetorical skill in order to create followers, to make allies. So back to these active literacies, because this idea is just decisively important, and yet I don't think I'm exaggerating to say that it literally doesn't exist in the minds of most people. There may be some vague tropism, but the idea of active literacies is the key to not only good citizenship, but to an effective set of powers in the marketplace, just doesn't occur, and schools allow it to die on the vine, so to speak. I mean, it's perfectly possible to acquire these outside of school if you know how important they are and will substitute television time or baseball time or whatever to get them. But if you rely on a school to make you adequate even at these things, you are in for an unpleasant surprise, because you will arrive at adult life uncomfortable speaking before strangers, unable to sustain an idea. That is, mostly what you'll do is register an opinion, sometimes emphatically. In writing, it's probably worse, because to formally write in such a way that you engage your audience is a tricky thing to do, and it's been studied for thousands of years. It's quite possible to learn and transmit, but someone has to first alert the audience that it's much more important than adding and subtracting, for example. It's the most important thing of all. So you can see how far we've deviated from that deliberately to force schooling, and we'll come to the purpose of that deviation in good time. The first purpose we call the religious purpose, to make good people. Let's call the second purpose the public purpose, to make good citizens. Good citizens argue effectively. They do not follow orders. They do not choose between the candidate they like best and the one they like least. That's not the role of a citizen. All right, the third purpose of schooling comes about with the general expansion of wealth and prosperity and easeful lives in Western society as our military and trading policies begin to dominate the planet. And that is, this is the thing probably that most parents, if they think about what the purpose of schooling at all is, think of the third purpose, and that's to make each individual his or her personal best, so that whatever their leanings are, that concentration on those and coaching and assistance will give that person their best chance to flourish personally. So we can call that the private purpose. And now we have three traditional purposes of schooling: to make good people, the religious purpose, to make good citizens, the public purpose, and to make people their personal best, the private purpose. Sometime around the middle of the 19th century, a fourth purpose arose, but it was outside the consciousness of ordinary citizens. And that was with the rise of fossil fuels. Remember that prior to the 19th century, for all practical purposes, your sources of energy other than human labor are wind and water and wood, and they're very, very unreliable. You know, they come and they go. And when the wood's gone, it doesn't come back for a long time. So most organized factory work was near some source of water or wind, or it relied on labor. So none of the institutional production mechanisms were very effective. They didn't dominate the life of the community. But with the development of coal and steam power, and then about a half century later, the development of oil, suddenly for the first time in human history, in the 19th century, managers, economic managers, had the ability to predict the future. They could work around the clock. They could make pretty accurate guesses about how many units they could produce in that time. And a need arose to concentrate people in urban centers for that purpose, to make them the assistants of coal and steam and oil. So with that understanding on the part of, let me call them society's managers, not just the rich, but people who devoted their intelligence and their attention to working out arrangements to multiply wealth. And so at that point, human beings ceased to be what they had been for all of human history, and they became pure and simply productive units, or less productive units, or unproductive units. The sentimentality that, in particular, the Christian religions lend to the social order, that your terrestrial achievement is inferior to your salvation, for example, or that you are your brother's keeper, I mean, we could talk about this for a week. But all those things could be set aside, an equation that led to industrial efficiency. Trouble is, we're now between 1830 and, for the most part, after the Civil War, right up through 1880. What we have is intense drawing room conversation about how to make the most of this radical transformation in economic life. Now, the guy in the street having a beer, I mean, he's aware of changes, but he's not aware that these changes are going to have to lead to radical changes in his relationship to management. The first attempts to manage people in this fashion, I mean, the American Civil War is really the first institutional war. It's the first war in human history where, you wouldn't know this from watching the movies, but where every unit wore the same uniform. I mean, the French Revolution, which wasn't very much earlier, every unit wore the uniform that the wife of the commanding officer designed and had caused to be made. The Napoleonic Wars did not look at all like the, you know, like the artistic renderings of them. I mean, they were crazy quilt, and so was the American Revolution there. But the Civil War, now think of this, because in a way it's exciting. It's an evil kind of excitement. But the Civil War said, there's 3 million of you, and you'll all wear the same hat and the same jacket, the same pants, the same socks, the same shoes, with, you know, minor variations in them. As soon as you can do that, when you know that one order for hats can make you quite wealthy, just a single order, and that these orders, as the heads get blown off, will continue over and over again, you have a situation ripe for political maneuvering. And you also have a motivation to think about the difficulties you're having making this managerial utopia work. Recall that the people being managed had come out of a libertarian tradition. Their ideal, their American dream, was to have an independent livelihood. But that certainly doesn't butter the steel manufacturer's bread at all, et cetera, et cetera. So there was so much difficulty trying to bend the American population to this new corporate economic style that the floodgates of immigration were opened for one of the few times in history. It isn't that people flocked to the United States for opportunity. They were brought to the United States and sold as they landed in wagon loads to brokers who then resold them to corporations, sometimes a long, long way from where they landed. Most respectable histories deal with this, but as I say that, the irony is that there isn't a school in the United States that actually has a respectable history text. All the texts have been politically modified. As I say, fortunately, there's plenty of first-class mainstream history that hasn't been, but most people don't read, and they certainly don't read long history books. And if they read one in a lifetime, they don't read the 4 or 5 a month that they would need to read to reconstitute the fallacious nature of the information in their minds. All this long-winded stuff is leading you up to a progressive insight that increasingly was made in those drawing rooms in which the livelihood, independent livelihood of small farmers and small tradesmen and craftspeople was about to be transformed into a corporate economy. And that insight was, well, the devil with trying to convince older people, we will pass legislation forcing them to yield up their children to be confined for long periods of time with total strangers who we will have a 100% influence on their hiring and on what they say. Now, if that isn't the single most radical idea in human history, I don't know what's close to it myself. And the very fact that we take these places for granted, if you reduce it to simple statements like, I want you to surrender your child for the next 12 years for the principal part of the day, 5 days a week, to a set of total strangers who you will know nothing about whatsoever. You'll be lucky if you know what they look like, or if you get 3 minutes with them in the course of a year to exchange platitudes with. Can there be a more radical idea than that, in giving your kid to strangers? Would you give your television set to somebody that you couldn't check up on? Well, I can guarantee you. You're in Canada, right?
Yes, that's right.
It's worse up there than it is here, but it's bad enough here. Now, what are these people supposed to do? Well, one of the things they inherited was the earlier rhetoric, rhetorical motives of schools to make good people and to make good citizens, to make people their personal best. But that's not what schools are about in the States or in Canada. In fact, the two national systems grew up intimately allied with one another, because the history of the Canadian state and its peoples was slightly different than that of the United States. There are cosmetic differences, but that's all. Edgerton Ryerson, who's the big name in Canada, and Horace Mann, who's the big name here, they're the names fronted. But they were in constant communication with one another. So they were out for the same thing. And what was that thing? They were out to produce a labor force which would not seek an independent livelihood, and were it so silly as to try, it wouldn't have the equipment, wouldn't know how to do that, would have habits indoctrinated into it that would prevent all but a tiny fraction of those people from finding a way out of the trap. The idea was to create a population that was susceptible to management. If you think just for a minute, the principal heritage in Canada, certainly the one that owns the country, is Anglican. And it's Anglican from particular parts of Britain, not the same parts as the mass settlement of the United States. I mean, the United States was settled by the dissenting population of Britain, the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. But the Anglicans are the state church of England, is the principal influence on the culture of Canada. So there are huge differences between those theologies, but let me call them philosophies, since most people are unaware of the theological roots of this. The school had to cancel out the dissenting mind that was coming from Britain. It had to cancel that out by training children in habits of obedience. If you think just for a minute, the principal heritage in Canada, certainly the one that owns the country, is Anglican. And it's Anglican from particular parts of Britain, not the same parts as the mass settlement of the United States. I mean, the United States was settled by the dissenting population of Britain, the Congregationalists and the Presbyterians. But the Anglicans are the state church of England, is the principal influence on the culture of Canada. So there are huge differences between those theologies, but let me call them philosophies, since most people are unaware of the theological roots of this. The school had to cancel out the dissenting mind that was coming from Britain. It had to cancel that out by training children in habits of obedience, not obedience to their parents, not obedience to their religion, not obedience to their traditions, but obedience to strangers hired by the political state. And once again, we're talking about major league radical here.
Scary.
Really is scary, because the ultimate purpose, once Darwin checked onto the British scene in the middle of the 19th century, The key was in hand to justify what was underway. Prior to Darwin's Origin of Species in 1859 and his Descent of Man in 1871, prior to that time, you had to justify elites and differential behavior by religion. The Anglican Church teaches in its homily of obedience that God has ordained all these different levels of society, and that to want to get out of your particular position is sacrilegious. That's a pretty good straitjacket. But it was also protected by the police power of the state. You could use superior wealth to hire police who would subordinate, and then you would own the means of making a living, and you would only pass those out to people who were docile. So, but the United States didn't have that for a long time, except in the British-controlled coastal parts of the East. Over the course of a couple of hundred years, what grew up, and the same thing was true, of course, in Western Canada for a long time, and prior to the telegraph and roads and cars and things, to actually reach out and fine-tune the life of communities was just impossible, except right near the large population bases. Mm-hmm. So quite a respectable, let me call it a libertarian population, occurred in both countries there. But gradually, with the rise of technology, easy transport, etc., that those libertarian elements were more and more marginalized. And then along comes Darwin, and what he teaches specifically, it's not an accident that Darwinism is probably the single great scientific truth, in quotation marks, truth, taught by schools. And it's taught in every school in Canada and the United States, not because there's a massive scientific proof that it took place. There isn't. But because, as part and parcel of the universal theory of evolution, I'm not arguing against the theory of evolution here, I'm telling you what its social and political ramifications are. Darwin said quite explicitly that not everyone was evolving. In fact, only a tiny fraction of the population was evolving, about 5%. The other 95%, 19 people out of 20, were evolutionary dead ends. And in his second big book, Descent of Man, he spells out what will happen if you allow the good breeding stock, the 5%, to intermarry with the bad breeding stock, the 95%. He said plain and simple that evolution would march backwards into the swirling mists of the dawnless past. Now, suppose for just a moment that you were a wealthy drawing room lady, or I was a wealthy drawing room husband, and we were chatting about these exciting ideas coming out of England, and suddenly we realized that almost everyone around us outside the sanctity of that drawing room was a dead end, making eyes at our daughters and sons, right? Mm-hmm. Ready to send the human race back into the swamp. That the amusing thing is that responsible people who bought into those ideas, and you couldn't very well not buy into them, just as today you can't very well not buy into them without identifying yourself as some kind of nut, as soon as you accept that, it's part of your responsibility as a superior citizen to build safeguards into the society to make sure that the bad stuff doesn't mess it up for the good stuff. Mm-hmm. How are you going to do that? Well, you can't do it for very long with your army and your police force, because basically your army and your police force are all bad stuff. Now, you can use them like a spot cleaner on a fabric, some stains on it. But what you can't do is extend a nonstop police pressure on the population. You have to do what John Calvin taught the English in Institutes of the Christian Religion had to be done to get the damned to police themselves. Calvin was writing in 1635, you know, 370 years ago, 369. And he said, these people have to be set against one another to police one another and to keep them out of the hair of the elect. Well, now, the theory of evolution is a secular theory, or so it appears on the surface. It's actually a different form of religious speculation. It says that a small fraction are elected biologically, and the rest are damned and dangerous. So how do you protect the good stuff from the bad stuff? Well, first you take the children away from the bad stuff, and you drill the children in forms of separation, of competition. You teach them not to trust one another. You teach them that they're in a deadly competition for livings in a very short time, that there's a huge dossier of numbers being accumulated, you know, that will dictate their entire future. It's all horse manure, but it's true if you believe it's true.
Well, if it's true of the schooling system and its grades, that it's all horse manure, but it's true if you believe it's true, something I'm trying to persuade the children with whom I'm working, then how much more true is it of the money system? I saw a bank advertisement the other day which said, here for good. And I thought, well, there's a double meaning there, and both of those meanings are lies. Of course, knowing the predatory nature of the financial system, I don't think they're here for good, and I don't think they're here for good in the sense that I don't think they're here to stay. I think it's not going to be very long before people who seem to be wising up on any number of topics inform themselves as to the reality of the financial system. And if people are not submitting to the schooling system and are choosing to educate themselves, then of course they are not so easily controlled. That has been my history for the last 7 or 8 years, finding out a whole bunch of stuff that I wasn't expecting, and increasingly I think this is the future. Those who have formerly counted on deceiving others must think again. We'll pick up on the rest of that interview from Radio Free School in our next episode, part 2 of Outing School.
Hard by the rich man to catch me and hang me, my shining black bitch.
The media used for this show are available for download at unwelcomeguest.net/538. All previous episodes of the show are available for download from our MP3 archive at unwelcomeguest.net/archive. The show has a mailing list at altruists.org/unwelcome if you're interested in giving feedback, suggesting ideas, or otherwise making a contribution. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. Thank you for listening. Keep giving all you can.
By unwelcome travelers, another brave